Let me tell you first this morning, if you are a visitor, that this is a congregational church. We do not have a creed to which everybody has to subscribe. So no one has to believe anything I say this morning or any other morning. And sometimes nobody does. We've been engaged for the past several weeks with some of the great ideas of the Christian religion. The idea of heaven and hell, of the Holy Spirit, of salvation, of sin, how these concepts began and how they have changed. And this morning, I invite you to think with me about the idea of a last judgment. You heard Matthew read some words from Matthew a few minutes ago about how the Son of Man, surrounded by angels, is to come at the end of history, sit on a throne, and judge the world by dividing people into sheep and goats. The good sheep, according to that dramatic sketch, will be invited to an eternal banquet. The wicked goats will be ordered out of sight and into a place of eternal punishment. Now, as you would expect, the Christian world divides on how those words are to be understood. For many, they are a literal statement of what will happen at the end of time. And when these believers speak of a judgment day, they have in mind a one-time only event with the same kind of reality as a baseball game in Royal Stadium. For others, the word pictures in Matthew have to be understood first in terms of his worldview, and then in terms of ours, and what has happened in 20 centuries of Christian thought. What we discover over and over is that religion always suffers from its symbolism. What I mean is that it takes an eternal truth and presents it in the figures of speech of a generation that understands those figures perfectly well. But then the centuries pass, and a whole new set of mental categories fill our heads, so that the old pictures, taken with prosaic literalness, become incredible. They actually get in the way of the truth they originally tried to express. What we have to do then is separate the local symbolism from the lasting truth. If you're willing, for example, to look critically at this scenario of a great last judgment, some interesting things come up. In the first place, there is no other gospel parallel to this vivid sketch by Matthew, a writer profoundly influenced by contemporary Jewish ideas about the afterlife. It is no surprise to discover that Matthew has lifted his description almost bodily from a Jewish apocryphal work known as the Book of Enoch, a strange, wild piece of religious literature which never quite made it into the canon of Scripture, but certainly had a tremendous influence on early Christian thought. Enoch and then Matthew both dramatized the notion of judgment in a way that made good sense in the world they knew. Anything less than a throne, for instance, would be inadequate for the judge of all mankind. And anything less than a huge crowd of all the people that have ever lived would be inadequate for making the point. I can't imagine either Enoch or Matthew considering for a moment how many people that would have to include, or how much room it would take to accommodate them. They were not statisticians. They did not imagine human history lasting as long as 20 centuries more. They could not have guessed how infant mortality rates would drop and life expectancy increase, so their minds were not disturbed by thoughts of the uncounted billions who have come and gone on this planet. They were interested in warning people to behave and to expect the consequences if they did not behave. And they framed their warning in dramatic ways rather than philosophical. Since everybody around them knew about sheep and goats, they picked those animals as symbols for good and evil. Syrian sheep were white. Syrian goats were black. The contrast was easy to spot, even at dusk. And the imagery reflects a simple Old Testament ethic. We live in a world of easily identifiable right and wrong, good and evil, white sheep and black goats. But we no longer see things that way. Character moves back and forth through innumerable shades of gray. We learn it even in Sunday school jingles. Like this one, there is so much good in the worst of us, and so much bad in the best of us, that it hardly becomes any of us to talk about the rest of us. I certainly agree, but that kind of compassion seems to have no place in Matthew's picture of a last judgment. And it makes some Christians wonder, especially when they try to figure out what Christ was really like and whether he can be fitted into the kind of harsh and simplistic judgment that Matthew has lifted out of the book of Enoch. For example, we see Christ himself being tormented and then killed by violent men, and all the time he is saying, "Father, forgive them, because they really do not understand what they are doing." If he could say this about men who were taking his life, how could he approve things written after his death in which uncountable millions of people are condemned to eternal punishment simply because they were ignorant? Could the extraordinary man who said, "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you," be so vindictive as to punish 60 or 70 short years of sometimes careless life by torment that never ends? I remember being impressed by the mothers and fathers of some of the hostages years ago who were held for more than a year by the Iranians. They refused to ask for any kind of retaliation. Can some of us be that forgiving and then suppose that God would raise people up from the dead where they are at peace from a troubled life and can harm no one for no other reason than to pronounce a formal judgment and consign them forever and ever to hell. One asks, what good would this be expected to accomplish? Punishment as a deterrent, we understand. Punishment in the hope of rehabilitation makes sense. But the traditional Christian hell serves neither of those purposes. That, by the way, is why Catholics long ago came up with the idea of purgatory. They found an eternal, hopeless hell, absolutely unreconcilable with the notion of a compassionate and understanding God. But if many modern Christians do not see a single judgment day in quite the way Matthew did, that does not mean they have rejected the notion of any judgment at all being passed upon their lives. When C.S. Lewis, with a smile, imagines God as saying to the archangel on the day of judgment, "Gabriel, bring me Mr. Lewis's file," he may not believe in all that paraphernalia from the forgotten book of Enoch, but he certainly does believe in the idea of judgment. And this is the judgment. To quote the words of John 3:19, that the light is come into the world and men have preferred the darkness. To put it another way, once you are exposed to the radiant good sense of the life and thought of Christ, judgment is passed on you when you choose how to respond. Light is always a judge. I remember as a teenager what a shock I had once. I came at early morning into a place, I will not tell you what kind of place, that had seemed quite romantic the night before. Soft candle lights, decor that looked rich and sumptuous in the gloom, but now in bright daylight was stale, cheap, shabby. Once the interior of a mind has been exposed to the way Christ looked at life, a constant judgment is passed on that mind as it makes its daily choices. Judgment is a reality, but it's happening all the time. What really fascinates me about Matthew's picture is not the billions and billions of people lined up on the endless plain with a huge throne and a giant ledger book. That may be too primitive to have much meaning for most of us, but there is a terrific relevance in the standard by which judgment is made. Religious groups like to talk about their worship ceremonies, how right they are, how better they are than somebody else's. They like to talk about the strength of their creeds and how vital it is that you subscribe to them. They like to talk about how free they are in governing themselves or in how structured they are. But none of these things is even mentioned in Matthew's picture of a final judgment. The only question is, the only question goes like this: what have you done for the family across the tracks. Ever made any visits to the local jail or its equivalent? Ever put clothes on a shivering back? Ever find a home for somebody who had no home? I'm not making this up. This is the question the judge asks in Matthew's picture of the final judgment. Does it jangle the nerves? Does it sound too much like the welfare state? The great society? Well, I think it wasn't meant to. I think nothing was being asked but what an individual might do out of his love, out of her substance. But I can think of times when it might have been not only the will of Christ, but in the best interests of the whole planet to have done this very thing. After World War I, Winston Churchill said, "It is our duty now, our first duty, to send ships loaded with food to the starving people of Germany." But his fellow Englishmen couldn't forget that they had fought and died because of that enemy. They were too full of hate to listen. Yet almost certainly, if they had done what he said, if, in other words, they and their allies had paid attention to the standard of judgment in Matthew's story, World War II probably would never have happened. The ugly plant called National Socialism, the Nazi Party, grew out of the hopelessness and poverty that we could have prevented. And one thing more, perhaps most striking of all in some ways, real goodness tends to be unaware of itself. The people in this story discover, not having known it before, that they have been on God's side all along. One of the surest marks of the true saint is that she forgets herself. I remember a man who worked hard through the week, but who took Matthew's hint seriously enough that he would choose one or two people in jail whom he thought a visit might help and go see them on Sundays. He did not preach. He made no romantic excuses for those he saw. He simply said, "Perhaps if someone cares now, in their humiliation and bitterness and despair, when they get out, they will remember, and maybe they will feel differently about themselves and about others." Some of the jailers made it obvious they thought he was only a fool. And most other people would agree. The doubt touched him at times. And he wondered. It certainly never occurred to him that he might be closer to the Spirit of Christ than most of us who had gone to church that morning. He makes Matthew's story of the surprised good person come true. But if people who never thought about their being good are surprised in this story of a judgment, so are the ones who think about it a lot and are smug and complacent about it. Their religious life so perfunctory that it never once occurs to them to link Christ with the people they meet on the street. They worship someone safely bottled up in an antiseptic church, separated long ago from the smelly business of daily life. So when they ask Jesus in Matthew's story, "When did we ever see you hungry or homeless or naked?" And the implication is clear. If they had known that the person in need was royalty in disguise, they would have fed and sheltered with marvelous courtesy. But common people, ignorant people who bring most of their sufferings upon themselves, alien and diseased people whose very existence is a threat, it never occurred to them that in such humdrum human life might be the embodied Christ himself, walking the streets of the kingdom in the flesh of all the wounded. But that is the incredible metaphor by which the followers of Christ are to identify all other human beings. We don't have to be gifted with much imagination to realize what a difference it would make if all who worship Christ in rooms like this were to find him in disguise in every life they meet when they leave. A final judgment with the skies split open, the trumpet sounding, the judge on the throne, two enormous files of people heading off in different directions to spend eternity, we will debate forever about how literal that image of judgment is. But there's one truth we can be sure about. Judgment day is every day.